Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the April 26th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. It's remarkable. I agree with you. He's an economist, an author, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. How are you, my friend?
I'm good, but I am desperate to hear about your UCLA activity. What you just hinted at it, and I asked you to share on. I don't think any listener wants to miss this. What happened?
Yeah, I won't share the gentleman's name, but somebody who's an MBA student is going to be they're in the Bank of America investment banking program and their M&A team, and they had reached out some time ago. I think they had read one of my books or listened to Capital Record podcast or something. And it asked if I'd speak to their class. They have an asset management course in the MBA program. And I said, yeah, I can't do it till the spring or whatever, but I'd be happy to. And remember, people can say I'm really mean to Bruins, but I have hired plenty of Bruins.
Hmm.
And I have some clients that are Bruins.
Hmm.
The only thing that maybe gets a little questionable is that I keep track of it because I won't go over a certain amount. And there's a lot of hand washing whenever I'm with my Bruin friends. Like I'm going to make sure that there's just kind of an atmosphere of hygiene, cleanliness. So anyways, I in all seriousness, I spoke last night to a group, I think 30, 40 kids. I mean, they're in their mid-20s, you know, they're grad students. Really, really sharp. Had a great conversation. They were so friendly. I really poured into some things I believe about stuff. I expected, generally when I speak to college audiences, they're by far the most skeptical and kind of whatever. These guys I really enjoyed it. And then I put my USC coffee mug out so it would be clear on the Zoom, and no one said anything. And that's very typical, by the way, of Bruins in general, but it's also extremely typical of Bruin grad students. Most people are not as emotionally connected to their grad school as they are their mm-hmm. undergrad mm-hmm. for obvious reasons. And then at the very end, we were signing off, and I just said, I want to leave everyone with one thing. And I just said, fight on. And I gave the fight on sign, said it, and I heard one person kind of gasp, and then I just clicked.
I love it.
I hope that people hearing that story will go, wow, I thought Bonson was really immature about this USC-UCLA thing. It sounds like he's
balanced.
He's better than I thought.
Poised.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of, I think they're also afraid to look you in the eye. And speaking of people who ought to have been more afraid to look somebody in the eye, the Mike Tyson story occurred while you and I were on a 5-day hiatus or whatever it's been here. I think almost everybody knows now that he's on an airplane in San Francisco last week.
There's so many tragedies to the story because you skipped over one of them.
He was
on a JetBlue airplane.
Why is that so horrible? Speak to the hoi polloi here, in which I include myself.
You know what? I'm not trying to be snobby here.
But?
And we all know that he famously lost $300 million of his $300 million of career earnings.
Mm-hmm.
So it is true that he's not in the financial position that he was. He's one of the most high-profile riches-to-rags stories in history.
Mm.
But I think he's rebuilt his financial position enough that I would think he's not flying JetBlue a lot. But
so he's on JetBlue. Guy starts talking to him, and as the story seems to be accurately reported, the guy starts, because he's drinking too much, he starts to pick on Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson, after having been kind and genial, turns into Mike Tyson prime fighter. There's video, which almost everybody here listening has probably seen. He turns around. The plane is still on the tarmac at San Francisco. I don't think the jetway, whatever they call that ramp thingy, has been pulled away yet. But Tyson turns around, kneels in his seat, and starts pummeling the guy with those quick sort of from chest to face punches. And the poor guy knows what hit him. He's been harassing it for 10 minutes. And then Tyson just stops, walks off the plane, walks over to police officers, apparently, and says, like, look, I just got hassled. I hit this guy. It's going to be a thing. So he handled it really well. I like Joe Rogan's comment that this passenger tried to headbutt a hornet's nest. I would think the first rule among most American men is don't pick on Mike Tyson. That's got to be like close to the top.
Right. And you could then from there extrapolate to some more granularity. Like, or really big offensive lineman, you know, or like UFC fighter. Like, there's just a sort of principle you're referring to that has other applications.
Yes.
But if you never are able to get there, if you're never able to connect the dots to other elements and extensions of the principle, if all you do is stay in the don't pick on Mike Tyson,
yeah,
you're probably better off.
That's right.
And maybe, like, I don't know, I bet there's some super, super tough guys from the 1950s that now, like, if I, like, let's go right now, it is like 93 or something. I suspect I could take him.
Maybe.
But I don't even know. I don't even know that. No. Like, that's a 50-50 to me.
Yeah, see, this is a thing.
But Tyson, I know he's older than he was in 1987 because so are we. I don't think he looks like someone I want to mess with
now. No, not at all.
I don't care. If you're 80 and you got a tattoo on your face.
Yeah.
I'm not touching you.
No way. Nope. He's speedbagged this dude. Yeah. And I'll say, you know, the extrapolation.
Did you
from-
see the whole tape? Tyson did not want to hit this guy.
No, he...
Tyson did not want to fight.
No, he kept trying basically to beg the guy off, please leave me alone. He was very kind.
My understanding is that the guy had friends across the aisle that were egging him on.
Oh.
And so here's the thing. Those are not very good friends.
No.
Because if I have a friend and I'm sober, which I would be because I'm sober 100% of the time, and I have a friend who's not sober, and my non-sober friend has decided, hey, this is funny, I'm going to go pick on Mike Tyson. One of the more responsibilities of the sober friend would be to say, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
I'll sit there. But they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then that dude got hit.
Yeah.
And I don't think Mike Tyson did anything wrong at all. And I think that obviously there was some self-restraint because the dude's still alive.
Yeah. He's got some scratches on his face and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I would have given him scratches on his face.
Because that's how you roll.
And that's not because of harassing me. That's just because I can't stand drunk people on an airplane.
Yeah.
It's the worst.
Yeah, you're right. His literal wingman on this flight was encouraging it. I have read reports of that. I think the interesting thing is that some people are trying to say, like, oh, this is, you know, this guy picking on Mike Tyson and then being shocked by the rebuke is evidence of how we've become so reliant and so courageous in social media, where you can say horrible things about people and it never comes back to haunt you because they might be thousands of miles away or not know who you are. I think it's simpler than that. I just think that forever, dumb people. I'm thinking about the guy, was it John Ford who shot, or am I mixing that name up with the director? The guy who shot Jesse James. There's an actual song. This just occurred to me. Do you remember this? Jesse James was hunted down by some young gunslinger and shot, I think, in the back. And Brian's looking this up already for us. No, Brian's looking at video of Mike Tyson speedbagging the dude on JetBlue.
I don't know who shot Jesse James.
But you do know.
But Jesse James, you're not referring to Sandra Bullock's ex-husband.
No, not that Jesse James.
You're referring to the old Wild West guy.
Yeah, who was gunned down because that's what people did in the day. They wanted to build their name by going after somebody who was phenomenally tough, right? And this is just a thing you learn, I think, by middle school as a guy, certainly. I can't speak for the female experience of this. I know all about Mean Girls and that sort of thing, but... You know, we just, you don't know. You know, I have a friend who is 5'7", I think, and was a special ops guy who could lift me over his head. And I'm almost 6'3". I weigh, you know, 190 pounds or so. I'm not tiny, but the guy could bench press me and was a very tough person. And he would not look like anybody to most people. He's just a little unassuming guy who can kill you. So you got to be careful. There's the Mike Tyson story.
And by the way, again, from the point of now to get past just the mere headline of this, and people want us to move on into other things. But the deeper point from those who desire more anti-fragile society, it is a very good thing for somebody to get videoed on TMZ acting this way and then getting their just desserts. Mm. Because you do want a kind of bold statement. If we say the words, hey, did you know that if you drunkenly mess with a guy like Mike Tyson, they could end up hitting you? There's some instructive value in it, but on a scale of 1 to 10, it's like 1 or 2. But when you get a video of Mike Tyson just beating the hell out of you on a plane, that's instructively, I think that's like 8 or 9. And Edmund Burke said, mankind will learn by example and no other way. This guy, yeah, this is just sometimes how people have to learn things. But I do consider it a net positive for society. And I do not commend violence. I do not commend, retaliatory. That's not what this was. This went too far. Tyson did what he was going to do, and this guy got what he deserved. And don't be a drunken disorderly ever. And then if you're going to be drunk and disorderly, don't mess with someone who could do that to you. And then if you're going to be drunk and disorderly and you're going to go pick on someone weaker than Tyson, then understand that you're going to get a whole nother set of punishment, because mm-hmm. then there'll be five guys that will have to deal mm-hmm. with you. Mm-hmm. So really, I guess the moral of the story is not about Mike Tyson. It is about being a drunken disorderly.
I think it is.
Just don't act like that way. You're yeah. a grown adult, idiot.
There's so many places we could go with that story, and so let me jump way down into the run list. And
At first, I thought it was because he wasn't wearing a mask. Oh my God, he's going to kill somebody.
For not or for wearing a
mask. Speaking of which, can I interrupt on the mask story?
Of course
story?
You can.
Have you seen the biggest bunch of BS ever to be presented as a poll in the history of polling?
That
states that 53% of Americans want the mask mandate on planes?
I have not seen that, but that is not surprising that that would be a poll.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm just going to tell you how I know the poll's wrong.
Tell me.
Because I'm not an idiot. Why are all the people who want a mask mandate on planes, the 53%, why are they not wearing them?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it somewhere between 7 and 9%, according to Delta, United, and American Airlines, of people who are voluntarily wearing a mask on a plane since they got rid of the mandate? Why did it go from 100 to less than 10%? Why is the entire airport totally free of people wearing a mask if 53% want? So it's utter nonsense. You could say, well, maybe it's people not traveling that want a mask mandate on planes. Well, God, I'm really curious what they think. While we're at it, why don't we ask my grandma who's going to win the NBA championship? I mean, what are you talking about?
Your grandmother can dunk. I've seen her. I wanted to jump down into the run list. Speaking of people punching back, this is my segue. This is my excuse for jumping down in the run list. Let's talk about Florida and Disney, if you don't mind. We talked about this last week, that Disney was pushing back, and it actually hired somebody out of California to run their political ops for them to support trans rights, gay rights, etc. And especially, particularly in Florida, where their espoused aim, their publicly declared aim was, we're going to make them repudiate and rescind this bill. This bill being the parent rights bill, which folks at Disney call Don't Say Gay. And hey, congratulations, folks at Disney. It never said gay, so you're powerful. In any case, Disney acts with impunity, I think, and just publicly declares, like, we're going to war. We're not supporting anybody who signed this bill, and we're going to do all these other things in Florida to make sure this bill is rescinded. What's interesting about it to me is that we all now know the story that Ron DeSantis, Governor Ron DeSantis, just signed a bill to revoke the Reedy Creek, whatever you call that, special district that Disney has run for years. We talked about that part of it last week, except for the fact that in the interim, DeSantis has signed the bill. So now people on the left are saying this is outrageous. It's government attempting to silence speech and that sort of thing. I don't think it's that at all. I think you and I discussed this. My own sense is this is one of those rare instances where a woke corporation, like Major League Baseball, for instance, when it pulled the All-Star Game out of Atlanta to protest voter access prohibitions in that state, which are completely, it's a bogus claim. But anyway, that's why MLB moved its game from Atlanta, I think, to Denver, if I'm not mistaken, played at the Rocky Stadium. But this is one of those rare times when a woke corporation stumbles around with impunity, it thinks, and punches a bunch of legislators in the head and declares that a widely supported, even among Democrats, bill that gives parents the right to have more transparency into what their kids are being taught, and specifically prohibits sex talk under the age of under fourth grade. So this is amazing to me, because as DeSantis said, let me see if I can find this here. DeSantis said last month, as a matter of first principle, I do not support special privileges in law just because a company is powerful. He's talking about this corporate carve-out that gave Disney complete planning, zoning, emergency inspections, tax collection authority over this vast tract of multiple counties in near Orlando. And Disney's response for that great favor from the people of Florida was, I think, to abuse it, to use the special privilege to do whatever they wanted and think they could punch a guy like Mike Tyson in the head and expect nothing in response.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I think that op-ed, a great point is, and it's the point you're making, not just in the particulars of what Disney did here, but in the fact that the moral hazard or a version of hazard, there was no reason for Disney to think there would be pushback, in the sense that a lot of corporate America is so used to having a crony relationship with their partners in government. And if I'm the Walt Disney Corporation and I'm extrapolating to my relationship with Florida lawmakers, the relationship they have with Orange County lawmakers, I would assume I'd get a free ride, that I could go sit, pick, whack the Mike Tyson hornet's nest. We're mixing up so many metaphors. It's crazy.
But it's all the same. It's be careful who you pick on. And corporations, you're right, have been able
to. But I think Disney has felt that they've gotten away with it for a long time in a lot of places. And in this case, they messed with the wrong people. I remain totally uncomfortable with the general principle of an act of a retaliatory action being taken against a company because of something that they do politically. But the difference here is that it's a perk they shouldn't have had to begin with. And so you could say that they're doing the right thing for the wrong reason. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people on the right are saying, like, who cares? This is war. We got to do what we got to do. I'm not really with them. Generally speaking, there's a precedent here that I'd be lying to not say has some slippery slope concerns in it to me. But at the end of the day, they did not say, we're going to raise your taxes. We're going to go create a bad law for you because we're mad at you. What they did was they said, we're giving you something good we shouldn't be giving you, and we're going to take it away.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little different.
How would you recommend the application of that principle in California? So you and I have, and I'm not even talking about necessarily just Disney, but all these corporations in California that tend to support things, the most extraordinary things in California, and yet also have one tremendous privilege. So there, I'll give you one example. We've got Elon Musk. We'll come to Elon in just a moment. But, you know, he has made a huge amount of his cash with Tesla on the backs of California taxpayer subsidies.
But quantify that for listeners, because it's a lot different than it used to be.
Okay, tell me.
First of all, he has never gotten that directly. His customers did, which is, of course, the same thing economically. But it is different than, like, Amazon was going to be given direct subsidies. Disney's received a gazillion versus a subsidy to the customer of a product to try to drive a certain consumer behavior that meets a social aim. And so a lower interest rate in a mortgage that's going to benefit Fannie Mae but is done to stimulate this social aim of homeownership, I think is convoluted and disagreeable. Just like I didn't think we should be incentivizing solar or electric or battery powered activity, and Elon benefited from that. So I don't believe in it and didn't believe in it, but it is different than the so-called economic growth argument. Mm-hmm. We're doing it because this company generates economic activity. Excuse me, that's what they're there for. They're supposed to generate economic activity. Like, we're going to give you some food because we noticed that you're eating food.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make any sense. I don't think you give someone money for existing. All right. So this argument that, like, hey, Disney's here creating jobs, so we're going to give them something different than we give other people, is a stupid argument. I don't want to do it for social aims either with Tesla or Fannie Mae, but that is a different problem than the one with rank direct cronyism. Now, Elon is currently worth $270 billion. He used to be worth $10 billion. And $10 billion is not that much money, as you and I know. At the time he was worth $10 billion, we estimated that Tesla customers had received $4.9 billion in subsidies. This is a study I did a long time ago, so I'm sure it's not updated anymore. But, you know, saying that, like, through some sort of indirect mathematics and maybe a little fidging and fudging to kind of make a model to work, that someone had maybe half of their net worth tied versus now 1% of their net worth, it's a little different. So I'm just trying to put the empirical facts on the table.
But at a time when his company really needed the support, California was there to support him. And then he had the temerity to speak out against the state of California during COVID, most famously, and then said, you know, screw you guys, I'm out of here.
But he also, putting his plant in Fremont was against his best interest relative to other options he had at the time.
Yes.
And when he did their second plant, which was really quite significant, he did go to Reno, Nevada, and he did a beauty pageant, and he got Reno to throw a bunch of things at them. But Reno didn't do it unique for Tesla. They went and the Nevada Business Commission basically said, we're going to create a Reno Tahoe industrial park, and we're going to try to get Switch and Microsoft. And there was quite an emphasis on bringing some technology companies to a place that had none of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was done in the way I recommend doing it. It was applied to everybody.
Yeah.
It was not a special carve out to Elon Musk.
Well, let's talk about special carve outs regarding Mousetown here. Anaheim, the headline, I think yesterday. Anaheim settles Angel Stadium sale dispute with state for $96 million. I told you when we were talking about this story yesterday. I read the story, and I think I begin to understand it this morning, but I'm still not close.
Tell us what you've come up with.
the dispute that is settled with the state has the city of Anaheim agreeing that they can sell the stadium for $320 million to the Angels' current owner, Artie Moreno. And they can sell it to him for $320 million if they give $96 million toward affordable housing in the city. That's what I understand. I have a problem with how much housing this is allegedly going to produce because the government will be involved. I'll talk about that in a sec. But first, have I got the basic story right?
Well, start with the first part. Before we get to the state's case and them and what they're paying and the affordable housing, only talk about what Disney gave Artie Moreno.
What did they give Artie Moreno?
Tell me.
Well, the hook here, just so listeners know, is that Disney owned the Angels for a brief period, beginning like 96, I think it was. Mid-90s, right?
Into
the early 2000s, I think.
And they owned, I mean, an Eisner CEO, and Disney was there when they won the World Series in 02.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think of what year Artie bought it. I think he bought it in 04. It could have been 03. It wasn't long after they won the World Series.
So they won the World Series. Artie buys it from Disney, buys the team from Disney, and the stadium lease goes along with it, correct?
Sure. Signable asset.
Sure. But Disney, if I remember correctly, had not paid anything for that stadium. Or maybe it was a dollar a year.
And the concessions sharing was totally biased against the city, and the parking. And it was just the most nonsensical BS crony deal you've ever seen. Artie inherits a sweetheart deal, but you know, like a great citizen of Anaheim who's obviously benefiting from this incredible deal that Anaheim gave to show what great, truly robust negotiators the good folks of Anaheim are, Artie rewards them by taking the name out of it.
That's right. They're no longer
changing
the
Los Angeles Angels.
That's right.
So then a gentleman by the name of Kurt Pringle, who, by the way, has come up on this podcast before without ever saying his name.
There you go.
But I can say his name in this context.
Voldemort.
Because this is just simply a factual deal. City of Anaheim decides to sue Artie because, you know, you have to have the name Anaheim in the city because of this deal they did. And it goes and they lose the lawsuit.
They lose it because the judge says he materially conformed with the obligation.
Because the geniuses that are, by the way, the single most incompetent group of people that you've encountered in adult life are the various people that have come and gone on the Anaheim City Council for the last 30 years. There are no words for how incompetent these people are. Not just immoral and crony. Because generally, there are cronyists that are immoral that can be really quite sophisticated, intelligent. Kurt's one of them. Kurt's a very intelligent guy. These people at the city council are just the D team of humanity.
Out of their depths.
So let me tell you what they did.
What they do?
They didn't say, hey, we're going to do all this, but you got to stay the Anaheim Angels. They put in this brilliantly, legally precise language that said, have to have it prominently displayed. So he changes it to the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. You know how many times in 20 years of watching ESPN I've heard them refer to it as the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim?
Never.
Zero?
Yeah.
So they become the Los Angeles Angels.
Right.
And the city of Anaheim pays $5 million in legal fees and tries to get that money back, and they don't. And the whole thing's a disaster. Very, very embarrassing to the then mayor of Anaheim, Kurt Pringle. Now, the rest of the stuff I have to say, I'm not going to say about what specifically to Kurt. I'm going to go back to now not mentioning names. But as we move on, everybody since this period of time, has been in a contest with Disney, with the Angels, other than this guy named Tom Tate, who became the mayor of Anaheim. He said, you know what? Disney's a major presence in Anaheim. I want to have a good relationship with them, but I'm not going to give away city resources that are ridiculously unfair for a multi-billion dollar corporation. So you have one person in this entire fable who was really kind of a hero. And as Tom ends up leaving office and now you have the different council members, you end up in this situation where they do this obnoxious sweetheart deal. And the only actor who has standing that can come fight it is the state of California. But they're not fighting it saying, dude, you guys are getting played. You look like complete idiots here. Yeah. They instead say, hey, sorry, but you have state regulations about affordable housing. And Anaheim ends up having to pay $96 million. So this is what apparently good Republican governance looks like.
Yeah, and it's bipartisan crony capitalism. You've got Rob Bonta there at the stadium to make the announcement, and he says in the press conference, this is a huge win for the people of Anaheim and our state, and the funds being invested back into the community here come directly from the sale of Angel Stadium. Then the mayor of Anaheim, Harry Sidhu, steps up and says, this is going to bring the largest investment in affordable housing in Anaheim history. Ooh. History. Oh. That is not true.
No.
Absolutely, fundamentally, on its face, a bald-faced lie. Not even just an exaggeration. History is a long time, for one thing, and Anaheim is a big, big city, and it has, I don't know, 350,000 residents now. It's a big, big town. And I am sure that the housing construction in the 50s and 60s in Anaheim far outpaced what's going to happen here with $96 million. $96 million. By the way, Harry says we have a target of building at least 1,000 units within 5 years. So do the math. $96 million, 1,000 units. That's $96,000 per unit, which is amazing because it's completely never been the case in recent history. You and I have talked ad nauseum about public affordable housing projects that clock in with per unit costs of $500,000 to $900,000 for an affordable unit. So if you really take the real numbers, let's just take the low end of that, $500,000 was the cost per unit to build a quote-unquote affordable housing in Venice. That would produce substantially less housing, a lot less than 1,000 units. And 1,000 in a city like Anaheim, that'd be something. But we're going to have something about like more on the order of 100, maybe 200 if at going rates. And knowing Anaheim, it'll be far less than that. There'll be a few pup tents to house homeless people in a parking lot somewhere, and the rest of the money will disappear.
I just wish that people on the right could understand the difference between being for markets and being for business. I'm for the concept of business getting done, because I'm for the concept of markets, which is a place in which freedom can reign, where there's free exchange, free transactions, where there is risk and reward properly distributed in a society in the context of freedom and, Lord willing, of virtue. The idea that our job is to support a business is totally counter to our view that we are to support markets. Nobody on my side of this issue and your side of this issue is anti-Disney. Now, by the way, I'm saying that meaning as far as like what deals they would get as a landlord or a vendor or somebody that is doing a transaction over real estate or services, parking, concessions. That what they're doing on the culture war stuff in Florida, I'm anti-Disney, meaning I see an agenda in their media empire. That's a separate situation. All of this stuff we're talking about going back to the 90s and the early 2000s with Disney and what they tried to get away in the 2000-aughts with hotel subsidies, this is not, my opinions have nothing to do with what they ended up doing a month ago in Florida. That's just gravy to the case of how of what a bunch of awful actors these people are. But look, I think if I was a leader in Anaheim, I'd want a great relationship with Disney. I would facilitate the great relationship with Disney in the same way I'd want to facilitate a great relationship with hot dog vendors, with janitors, and with people who are starting small businesses, maybe they have an Airbnb operation, maybe they have a Motel 6, and that is by facilitating the removal of impediments from doing business. Low tax, low regulation, all the things that city, county, state, federal, empire ought to be doing, or overseer ought to be doing. There is no reason for us to equate that we do not want giveaways to billionaires as saying we're being anti-business. I'm being pro-market. And all Disney's doing is making fools of these people. They do not care about market principles. And what they tried to get away with doing on that hotel tax was absolutely abominable. Now on this situation with the Angels, they're all deathly afraid. And what is Artie Marino supposed to do? Mm. Are you supposed to turn down money that a city is desperately Mm-mm. trying to give you? Mm-mm. And so it's crooked as all get out. Most of these people, I again want to reiterate, I'm not saying any names here. A lot of people in city council end up going and lobbying for these companies after mm-hmm. they get out of office and have indirect revenue streams and benefits. And there's government affairs offices and things like that. So I guess people can draw their own conclusion about what they think about that stuff. But you're getting played. I'm pro markets. And sometimes that leads me to say we don't need to be giving free things to Amazon, Disney, etc.
Let's turn to a couple of quick headline stories. Don't need to drill too deeply into this. In the Kamala corner, Jill Biden's anger at Harris detailed.
Oh, Kamala just tested positive for COVID.
Did she really?
Right now.
Oh my gosh,
I'm outraged.
Yeah, terrible.
What the hell was wrong with her?
Unbelievable.
Going out and getting a cold.
Unvaxxed. Yeah.
Well, and she is vaxxed, so yeah. Probably. She was not wearing a mask, and she was around someone.
Around people. She wasn't social distancing.
You know what?
Properly.
There could have even been some viral droplets involved.
Could have been. Unbelievable. Disgusting.
I think the only thing to say here is that this is a scarlet letter. She won't soon live down.
Having COVID?
Yep.
Yeah.
The shaming of people who got COVID done now? And I guess it is with... I guess it kind of is.
Well, no, because the left, you might remember a story we did a few weeks ago where we had loads of columnists, including Michael Hiltzik at the LA Times, the execrable Michael Hiltzik, who first opposed vaccines and then supported them. And the only change in material factors was not the vaccine, but who was president. When Trump was president, he said, this vaccine will kill you. A few months later, Biden wins and suddenly the vaccine will save you. And he was talking in that context about how the left should celebrate, Americans should celebrate the death of any person who refused to get vaccinated and who was public about it. He said that sort of public shaming was the only thing you could do. So talking about Kamala getting a cold that is now, you know, tested for COVID, I think it's a reasonable thing to talk about because, of course, she, we might argue, has the best of health care and is one of the promoters of the myth about how to avoid COVID. And now she's.
Well, yeah, but that's what you mean by to talk about it is to talk about how all of the stuff they say is not true.
Sure.
She got COVID because you can't help getting COVID.
That's right.
Because COVID's super infectious.
That's right.
And also, nothing happens.
Doesn't kill you generally.
Or for a fully vaxxed person, it's not going to do a thing.
That's right.
She's not going to know she has it.
Yeah.
So my whole thing here is they should say, okay, Kamala got it, and we would like to apologize for other people we previously COVID shamed.
Yeah, there you go. I love it. Let me just bounce through these stories really fast because we got some big ones to take on still. But here's some fast ones. Fox News, Jill Biden's anger at Kamala Harris, detailed in a new book. Book by Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns. The book forthcoming, This Will Not Pass, Trump, Biden, and the Battle for America's Future, describes the vice presidential nomination process during the 2020 campaign. We all have heard that Jill Biden did not like Harris, that she, the quote in the book is, why do we have to choose the one who attacked Joe? Because, of course, Kamala did. But Biden's inner circle told the reporters that having Harris on the ticket was important to Ron Klain, now the White House chief of staff, who was tasked with finding the vice presidential candidates, according to the book. And he told Biden early on that Harris was the most qualified for the job. Why? Because she had sought the presidency herself. Let that sink in. She had sought the presidency herself. She flamed out in a very high-profile disaster. Her entire campaign team imploded. She never gained any real traction, not even here in California, where she polled well behind all the other candidates. She's a disaster. But the fact that she ran was apparently enough for Klain.
But why would that not apply to, what was her name up in Santa Monica? The gal who's the author.
Marianne Williams?
Marianne Williamson?
Yeah,
Marianne?
I think so.
Why would that not apply to Herman Cain?
He's not a woman and she's not black.
Okay, but so it only applies to African-American women?
Yes.
As part of a qualification is having run?
Having run. Tulsi Gabbard?
Yeah, but, you know, that, okay. So that's what it comes down to is... They don't believe running for president makes you qualified. They believe being an African-American woman who unsuccessfully ran.
That's correct.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it doesn't. So that's all your point is. By the way, it's unnecessary for him to make the point. Biden already said, I'm picking her because I promised I'm going to pick a black woman.
That's right.
But so this isn't like we're reading between the lines. No. Just so you guys know, they only picked her because she was a black woman. Biden said it. Yeah. I didn't say it.
No, we didn't say it. Yeah.
But why would... But that is a really weird can of worms to open.
It's bizarre.
I think... So who else has run for president that we now could say has got kind of a leg up as a more qualified? Would you argue that like Mike Huckabee is kind of a leading candidate for... Maybe he is. I've never heard that being an unsuccessful primary candidate adds to your vita.
It's bizarre. The book goes on to say that that Biden had his own reservations, noting, quote, her past romantic relationship with Willie Brown, the former San Francisco mayor who had appointed Harris to a pair of minor political positions. Biden reportedly said that kind of thing should be off limits. Yeah, I would think so. That kind of thing. Sleeping with somebody who then gives you two minor posts to start your political
career. I totally disagree.
You do? Tell me.
I'm old school, man. Bring it. Just kidding. Hashtag.
Just kidding.
Me too.
Okay. So I could go on. There's just, I'll put the story in the show notes. Loads of fun. Here's one of my favorite writers, I got to say. He's very, very liberal. Joe Matthews at San Francisco Chronicle and elsewhere. His headline is California is Aging, which is what makes Feinstein the perfect representative. You'll remember that Dianne Feinstein is now showing signs of real mental decline, as reported by the Chronicle. Matthews argues that, in fact, that makes her perfect to represent California. And I think his reasoning is very interesting. Our very senior senator, more than any other political leader in the state, actually represents California's future. And while those political insiders campaigning to force her to retire may be correct about her diminished capacities, they fail to recognize just how much she resembles who we Californians are and what we're becoming. California's future, like Feinstein, looks old. So his whole argument is total, I think, satire with a really explicit point, which is that economic policies are destroying California's youth. I have four kids, three of whom already live outside of California in large part because of the cost of living here and the opportunities available to them elsewhere. There is nothing I have said on this show, I think, there's nothing so sad for me, or very little that has been so sad in my life, is packing up a U-Haul for a kid who's moving with his wife out of state. I've done that now three times, and it hurts every single time. I got one left, and she's going too. So the point is that my little microcosm of a family is representative of a much larger demographic shift in California. That is, young people are leaving. They cannot afford to get started here. And if they don't leave, they sometimes become permanent residents of their parents' house, or they live in, you know, really cramped conditions. They cannot aspire. Because of California's policies, they can't aspire to something more. Now, I disagree with Matthews about what we should be doing. He says, we got to invest more in education. That would help. We should have state-supported childcare. That would help. He's playing on the fringes of stuff. He is trying to address the symptoms of an underlying rot in California. We talk about it all the time on this show. It will not be a surprise to anybody here to hear us say the real problems have to do with the kind of BS policy coming out of Sacramento and our myriad cities and counties in this state, where the government has simply pushed businesses aside, crush them under the regulatory burden, raise taxes for everybody, fail to provide water, fire protection, you name it. We have a government that cannot govern. That's the problem. Anyway, Matthews, you might remember David from a conversation we had in January. He's the guy who proposed abolishing parenthood because good families are an unequal benefit. They produce privilege. And again, he was being Jonathan Swift here. Remember this?
No, that's what you and I concluded. But yes, a lot of people, there was a lot of debate as to whether or not he was being such.
He was being such.
No. I assumed such.
Yeah.
In fairness to those who thought it was serious, there's been a lot of things in the last few years that I would have. I'm not being funny, Will. I swear to God.
But it is funny.
There are things that I would have thought were satirical that turned out not to be.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the top one on your mind? Like, can you think of something? What's the most outrageous thing? Or not, it doesn't have to be the most. What's an outrageous
thing? It's totally offensive. But I think almost everything I hear on the transgender discussion,
yeah,
I assume people, I don't, this thing about a swimmer, a male swimmer,
yeah,
I this is a major story. This is a real deal. I can barely interpret it as anything other than something that people are joking. They're doing a complete parody of thought, and it is a deadly serious story. But if you want me to make a list of all the things that have transcended, you know, Neil Postman's famous exhortation that we're amusing ourselves to death, I could tell you so many examples in the last 5 years that would take up this podcast and the next three episodes. And I'm not being like a smart aleck.
Mm-hmm.
There's stuff that literally I would just take at face value as someone being funny, and it's not. So in this case, that thing, the context of it helped me to derive your interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
But on a headline level, I didn't know for sure.
No, you wouldn't. This is why the Babylon Bee is based in California.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you. Please. Also, in fairness to some, I'm thinking of a particular intellectual friend of mine who thought it was very serious. It was also the way it was responded to.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of serious interaction.
That's
with
right.
It.
Yes.
So you kind of assume if the counterpoint is serious, the point must have been serious. And
by which you mean, I remember reading the comments behind that story about abolishing parenthood were a lot of people who took it seriously and in a way that was like, yeah, you know, this actually may make some sense. Part of his argument, you know, that should have clued people in was he said, I think the rich should immediately give their children to the homeless and the homeless give their kids to the rich.
Yeah, he said some things that were clearly like just almost too funny.
Yeah.
If he was trying to make a serious point.
But people took it seriously. Yeah. Hey, I'm going to skip down because shortness of time.
Well, I got an email when you said, is Jonathan Swift?
Yeah.
That someone wrote me and said, well, wasn't Jonathan Swift serious?
Yes, he really wanted us to eat Irish babies. Uh-huh. Which in California could be true. Soylent Green is babies. We're the abortion tourism destination. Hey, I want to jump to a couple of other things here. There's a Stanford University professor, Michelle Mello, who has issued her declaration that a new bill in the assembly that would punish doctors who promulgate, disseminate COVID misinformation could have their licenses taken from them. You and I think, are pretty much free speech absolutists. Ms. Mello teaching it.
No. I'm not a free speech absolutist in a professional trade. If a doctor comes out and says, I think it is healthy for someone to smash their head with a hammer,
mm-hmm,
I think that person should face licensure threats and other issues related to their own craft.
Okay.
Okay?
Fair enough.
The problem here is that we're talking about things that are clearly not facts of record.
Not hammer on head.
Yes.
Clarity. Right?
And so I do not agree that a doctor should be allowed to say things inside the AMA. Like, in other words, if I say, as a financial professional, one of the most responsible things you can do with your money is go bet it all on black, I can lose my license. And I think that the Securities Exchange Commission, and I think that FINRA, and I think various state and federal regulators have the right to do so under the professional code. I do not believe that what we're talking about here has anything to do with that.
Okay. And she would use all the examples that you've just provided as evidence that the bill now pending in the state legislature is legit. Like, we limit speech in all kinds of ways, and therefore we should limit it in this way. So talk to me about, let me just read really quickly. Here's the key line, I think. Vaccine.
Do you remember when President Trump asked if pouring bleach was a good way?
Yes, injecting.
And I actually don't think he meant something as stupid as it sounded, but I do think it sounded very funny and stupid.
And it's possible it was.
Yeah, you never know. But like, if a doctor said, I really believe the best way to treat a child's cold is that they pound a whole bottle of arsenic.
Uh-huh.
Would you think that that doctor should be liable for that?
Yes, I would.
Okay.
Okay.
So, we're all on the same page here.
Yeah, so that's her argument, right? That's her argument. If we can limit speech with babies with bleach.
We're not disagreeing on the principle. We're disagreeing on the application.
Okay, thank you. And that's her argument, too. It's just about the application here. And she says, vaccine misinformation during the COVID-19 pandemic underscores how reverence for freedom of speech in the U.S. intensifies our vulnerability to public health threats. Reverence for free speech intensifies our vulnerability.
She's wrong.
Okay, talk to me.
Free speech is not the problem. The issue here is legitimate scientific debate. And this has happened over and over again. And this was a great point that Joe Rogan made when there was allegedly a little controversy on the Spotify podcast. There is simply no question that the public health bureaucrats who have authority, how do you define authority? Who has the power? Those who can produce sanctions. So a doctor in Fresno says, hey, 98% of the people I'm seeing are coming in with barely any symptoms. There's really not a outcry here requiring a ton of hospitalization, and we have a number of different treatments that are able to mitigate. And it was in line with the national data that was still showing something in between 0.2 and 1% that it became more serious. And they said, oh my God, the outrage is horrible. COVID's killing everyone. And over time, there were a gazillion times that the CDC's declarations were changed. The entire story of vaccination. You and I have been on the record over and over and over again, and I still am now. I'm as pro-vax now as I've ever been. However, the vaccine community initially did not say it will mitigate severity. They did say it will avoid infection. They treated it like a polio vaccine instead of more like a kind of
a flu
shot.
Mm-hmm.
And so to the extent that what we call the vaccine, I never had a problem with mRNA. I never had a problem with the red tape reality of it being emergency use authorization. A lot of things other people that included folks who would write us and call us, you know, were all up in arms about. It never bothered me. But it does bother me. They sold it totally wrong and never admitted it,
mm-hmm.
and never treated natural immunity as if it were actually a very relevant fact.
Mm-hmm.
They spent 9 months telling us we had to spray down every single
yes.
thing we touched and
That's
bleach
right.
the hell out of this and that. They spent over 2 years saying that the airplanes were somehow more dangerous oxygen than all the other oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now you say a doctor has a different interpretation of some aspects and that she wants to take away their license or have criminal punishment. It's not in the category of settled science. It's in the category of very legitimate professional disagreements. So let them handle it in their vocational and professional community. Let their peer-reviewed analysis play out, okay? Because already we're seeing that plenty of very interesting peer-reviewed analysis from Johns Hopkins, from Oxford, pretty reputable institutions.
I've heard of these places.
Are now basically saying, okay, yeah, the infection rate's a hell of a lot lower than the case rate.
Mm-hmm.
And other things that we've been saying all along. That, yeah, remember that whole controversy on the outdoor detection?
Yes.
And they end up saying, oh, it looks like it's less than 10% of people
right.
who got it outdoors. And they go, yeah, because it is less than 10, because it's zero.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's why I'm bothered, because guys like me, and I think you, that do want people to be held accountable professionally for when they say something wrong, this can't be treated as one of those things because they didn't say anything wrong. There are a lot of differing opinions in the medical community, right?
This is how we get a new standard of care. Otherwise, we'd still be, I don't know, measuring people's craniums and applying leeches. Yeah.
Oh, you don't believe in doing that anymore?
I believe the standard of care has advanced to fly larvae.
Is that settled science?
It was as of 1720.
So why is it? Why I'm just curious, is the AMA not a powerful institution?
AMA is supporting this. As CMA is, rather. I'm sorry. California Medical Association. This
the
is
AMA
a weird thing.
Is not, the AMA is not.
No, I don't know that the AMA is or isn't, but I do know that the California Medical Association, weirdly, and I should try to figure out why. A number of doctor friends of mine who I hang out with have said, They're just shocked that CMA is backing this limit on speech. And they think it's because the CMA has become so reliant on the Democratic supermajority that they're afraid to put themselves in the crosshairs of regulators. So they really want to appease Newsom and others.
Well, that's the need of the hour, is someone to cower in fear.
Yes.
Instead of standing up to a bully.
Yeah.
That's actually what I try to always teach my kids. Is you have to let the bad guys win. That's the right thing
That's
to
right.
do.
That's right. Yeah, always back down from a fight and dance when they shoot bullets at your feet.
You want to know what I would do if I were a doctor and CMA was doing it?
What would you do?
I'd go to fucking war.
Yeah.
That's what I would do.
I have tried.
I would lose my license over it.
Yeah, I have tried to talk to my
Once
doctor
Once I was
friends.
Rich, I would lose my license over it.
You're a doctor. Of course you're rich. All right. Last story here, David, that you know I'm just really trying to push us toward this deadline here. I found a really interesting press release from April 18th on the governor's website, which I had missed last week when we recorded. California advances global climate leadership through expanded partnership with China. I find this absolutely interesting. You know, our listeners know, regular listeners anyway, know that I was a commie back in the day, and I supported something called municipal foreign policy, which started out municipal foreign policy. Let that sink in. That means cities having their own foreign policy.
Okay, so you supported something, what is MF for short?
We did, and it was called MF.
Yeah.
And we delighted in that. We had a magazine called The Bulletin and then of Municipal Foreign Policy, but its little headline was MF. We loved it. Anyhow, the idea there was that we get radical cities like L.A. and Berkeley and others to create sister city relationships with then Soviet Union. This is in the 80s. And we could get them to ban chlorofluorocarbons and do recycled stuff and create sanctuary cities, et cetera, you name it. So here's California
no
now.
No wonder you guys lost the Cold War. I mean, you were spending your time on this. You know how much other stuff you could have gotten done for the communist movement if you weren't busy worrying about chloroform or something?
I'm not chloroform.
What did you, I mean,
chlorofluorocarbons, those are the things out of hairspray that disintegrated the ozone. Created the idea, the information, the insight created by a UC Irvine professor named Sherwood Rowland, who was a, I think, NBA prospect as well. He was like 6'9" and a Nobel Prize winner. That's neither here nor there. So anyway, it's this idea that California can create its own kind of foreign policy agreement with China. And of course, we all know Governor Newsom is running in 2024. That's his ambition here. So you look at this through that lens. And what he's saying is basically like, look, whatever the U.S. does, that's fine. But California is the leader. Here's the line from the press release, April 18th, put it in the show notes. California is a global leader in combating the climate crisis while growing our economy. But we can't tackle this existential challenge alone, said the governor. Today's memorandum of understanding deepens California's strong climate and clean energy ties with China, bolstering our efforts to expand clean transportation, carbon neutrality, and accelerate nature-based climate solutions. I love that, nature-based climate solutions. All of this is so propagandistic that it is absolutely outrageous and frustrating to me to even read. This idea, in a linked press release, Governor Newsom joins Biden to uplift California's vision for an inclusive, sustainable, clean energy economy in Lithium Valley. Lithium Valley sounds like Valley of the Dolls. It sounds like a drug, but you and I both know that it's an integral component in creating batteries, and a huge deposit is believed to be below the Salton Sea. So Newsom keeps using this word clean to quote one of my favorite movies. Oh my gosh, Princess Bride, is that the movie where the guy says...
I don't think that word means what you think it means.
That word does not mean what you think it means. Inconceivable. So he keeps talking about clean energy.
By the way, congratulations in the aftermath of not knowing about the game and the Stanford debacle with Cal. Congratulations on having seen the movie Princess Bride.
Thank you.
So you were not dead for the entire 1980s.
I was not. That was the time when we started having children and they wanted to watch movies like Princess Bride. So. Right. Yeah.
Great movie.
One of the great movies of our time, seriously. I always loved Peter Falk. So
I've laughed at Princess Bride almost as much as I laughed at Cal running that touchdown back on Stanford.
I never told you that we got so many emails. I think they ran 10 to 1 people expressing shock that I did not know about that game.
Who were the one?
One was
people
a lady.
People that also knew about the game but just weren't shocked that you didn't?
No, the ones, let's say there were three people in support and about 25 to 30 who just said, really? You didn't know? But all, I think there were two women and one man, all of whom admitted that they don't really have an interest in football.
You know, I was having dinner with my family that night after we recorded, and so Jillian's like, oh, how was your day? And I said, yeah, I recorded Radio Free with Will, and I said, yeah, you never guess what happened. And I explained it. She goes, that guy didn't know about that play.
I'm embarrassed.
And then my little boy's 11 started laughing. And then my daughter is 14. And she was making a TikTok at the time and was getting ready to watch the new Kim Kardashian show. She goes, what kind of loser didn't know about that play? So, yeah. Well, our family covered
that's
them.
That's brutal.
Moving around the horn.
You've raised them right. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So you've got Biden. You've got, you know, celebrating California's climate leadership, and it's always about clean energy. And I just wanted to point out one thing. I've talked about this before. Lithium is not clean. Mining it is not clean. And the Salton Sea area of the Imperial County and far south California is one of the most environmentally challenged places in California and maybe even in North America. It's a place where the Salton Sea, which was created by a kind of a natural inflow of water from the Colorado, and then it just hung out there for years, and then a bunch of developers came in, and then the water receded, and as it receded, all these homes that had been developed and resort area, it was just really something in mid-century.
And there's a documentary on this whole thing that someone could watch. I'm pretty sure it's on Netflix. It may have been on one of the other streaming services, but I would, you know, I normally don't say, oh, you'd really find this documentary on the Salton Sea fascinating, but I got to tell you, Jolene and I watched it. This was a few years ago. It was before COVID when I saw it. It was absolutely fascinating. So if people want to learn more about this because it ties in to the point you're making, find this documentary, and it was quite enlightening. Maybe if you find it, you can put it in the show
notes.
I'll
do that, yeah. My bottom line point here, David, is just that, and you know this, there is nothing.
It comes up constantly.
It's clean. There is no such thing as clean.
Okay, but just like people in economics, Will, can get away with doing this all the time. Hey, if you didn't spend this money on this, you could have spent it on this and it would have been better. And there is this zero-sum fallacy. There is this lack of understanding of incentives. There's a lack of understanding of all sorts of economic principles that cause people to say very dumb things. And they rely on the fact that other people hearing it also don't know the most basics of economic truisms. With energy, the political class banks on the fact that people don't know what you're saying. Do you know how many people that are grown adults and college educated I have talked to? Then I will say, we are going to need a ton of natural gas to power electricity. And they say, what does natural gas have to do with electricity?
Yeah.
And then I say, well, no, I guess we could just use coal. And they go, what does coal have to do with electricity?
Yeah.
So this notion, what you're getting down to, that's all it is that you can look at one aspect in the energy process of physics and say this is a cleaner deal and ignore what steps were necessary to get there or steps that come necessary later, like disposal.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you to make a scientifically inane point that is politically attractive.
Well, we'll come back to all that over the course of probably the next decade. And just, you know, we'll especially delight in tracking, I think, the environmentalist outrage as mining on lithium mining begins in California. We will have environmentalists coming out of... Are they allowed to come out of the woodwork or just out of the woods? They will be very upset.
For a while, there was a thing where they were putting... Did we talk about this when they were putting Teslas on ships to go to, People are so funny. I'm
telling you. Hey, last story, and then I want to get to an interview that I did. I'll tell you all about that.
I would like you to call an audible, though, on a story that just came up while we were in the middle of recording.
Harvard to spend $100 million to study and redress its ties to slavery. This is the Harvard that's not based in California in West LA, right?
Harvard University is going to spend $100 million to study their ties to slavery.
Hmm.
What exactly kind of world are we living in that this is now going to be responded to? It's like, oh, good. I'm glad Harvard's doing that. What if Harvard just came out and said, okay, we did our study. It was this morning. I was having a coffee. And we assumed that in the 19th century, we had some people that were awful and doing bad things because there were so many awful people that were slave owners and other things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have this $60 billion endowment. And we still, we don't support lighting money on fire.
Mm-hmm.
We consider that bad.
Mm.
But you know what? We do have some extra money, and we're going to spend $100 million supporting African-American scholarships or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you going to spend $100 million for a study? Who does that besides people like Harvard?
Well, I want to know which historians are going to pay to do this. And, you know, I mean, this is what Harvard does. I don't know. It's just...
I want to interview the president of Harvard in 1855.
You know what? On the Capitol record, you could probably get that. I'm sure you could figure out a way.
This doesn't have an easy California connection. I like how you said Harvard Westlake, which that's actually what they pay their football coach.
Yeah.
So they maybe are going to do a similar study.
Probably not. Hey, I want to just do one last thing. My friend Brandon Ristoff, who worked for us for just a year and a half, too short, my friend, has gone on to the private sector, and I mean the for-profit private sector, I should say, because I'm private sector, just public. A nonprofit. But his parting gift to us, among other things, was a quick study. He's a guy who set up this Union Watch bot that we, as we call it, that scrapes campaign contributions from government unions to political interests. And his report for the first quarter of 2022 is out. I'll put it in the show notes. Huge surprise here, David. Almost all the money from government unions, in fact, all of it goes to Democrat or Democratic adjacent party politics. Not a surprise at all. The five largest givers in reverse order: California Professional Firefighters, CAL FIRE, that's part of the state firefighting group, SEIU 721, the California Faculty Association, and number one position, California Teachers Association, contributed in the first quarter $462,000 to the Democratic Party. They gave $185,000 of that. So, more business as usual from our friends in government unions who give only to one party, the party that helps them write the regulations that keep them in power. David, coming up next, talk about audibles. I neglected to tell you and or Brian or Glenn that I did an interview with Lance Christensen on Friday. Lance is not only a colleague at CPC, he's also a candidate for state superintendent of public instruction. Tony Thurman, the Democrat, has that job. Lance and I are going to go in here in just a moment. You'll hear us talk about what Tony Thurman has done, has not done, and what, most importantly, a state superintendent does all day or could do in the hands of somebody like Lance. And I'll let Lance tell you who he is. So, Sarah, if you don't mind, just go ahead and roll that tape. And oh, by the way, Brian and David, I end that segment with the outro, so no need to worry about that. Here's that interview with Lance. Greetings, Lance. Welcome to the office adjoining mine. We're in, let's call it, the separate studios here at California Policy's headquarters. Lance, you're in town for, I think, the Republican convention. Is that right, this weekend?
I am. I'm here to see if they'll endorse my candidacy for state superintendent of public instruction.
Well, we'll come back to that. And we're here, of course, to talk about the fact that you're running for this office that I am going to guess most Californians could not identify if they were given a cheat sheet. What is the superintendent of public instruction? Who's in it now? What does that office do?
So the state superintendent of public instruction is the constitutional office. It's actually the only nonpartisan constitutional office. So you have governor, lieutenant governor, you know, controller of those guys, attorney general. The superintendent of public instruction's job is to oversee all of the public school system in the state. And it kind of includes the other stuff too, private schools, homeschools, in a way that they have to apply to have their private school status. And the superintendent oversees the Department of Education, which gets a lot of this stuff. Superintendent deals with other compliance and auditing issues, and really is kind of the person in the state of California. Right now, the governor has taken that position over and seems to do everything that the superintendent should be doing. But in reality, the 1,000+ school districts in the state and others ultimately get direction from the superintendent. And right now, I would agree with you, probably if you asked 100 people, 99 of them would have no idea the office existed. And out of that one person, you'd flip a coin and know if they knew who that person actually is.
Let's flip the coin. Who is that person? And why do you want to replace him?
So Tony Thurman is the current superintendent of public instruction in California. He's a former state assemblyman. He was a school board member. He's gone through the ranks, but basically he's the California Teacher Association's person. And as we know, the teachers' unions are different from the teachers themselves. And they advocate for one thing and one thing only. It's for themselves. They don't advocate for the kids. This is not the California Students Association. As has been mythically said before, if kids paid dues, they'd care. But they don't. So he does a lot of the bidding of them. And it was interesting when he ran for office back in 2018. So California has this off-cycle elections from the presidential races. When he ran, he committed that he would do everything he could in his power to actually go and figure out how to handicap or kneecap charter schools. And that actually was his platform. So when he got in office, by March, he had already completed a task force and put together recommendations that would severely limit the ability for charter schools to grow and to thrive in California. And we watched what happened in the legislature. They marched lock, stock, and barrel to do the same things, to cut their funding, to cap their enrollments, to make sure that they were highly regulated, that they were paperworked so badly that they couldn't open up any more campuses and kids would be stuck in failing schools.
Hey, you make him sound like a really wonderful guy. So what could you do, though, from my lips to God's ears? You run for this office. The primaries in January. We'll come back and talk about, you know, the kind of the logistics there. But let's say you win. What can you do in this office? What can the superintendent really do if he or she, in your case, if you oppose the California Teachers Association, see them as a kind of a pernicious force? I think most of our listeners will know why that is, but you can include in your answer why at least providing a little bit of pushback on the CTA might be critical here. But what can the superintendent of public instruction do?
Well, let me give just a little bit of background on my end so that I think this all makes sense. You've known me for a long time, but I've spent 20 years in and out of the education system. I was a fourth grade educational assistant in Denver, Colorado. That means I didn't have a teacher credential, but I taught there and I worked with other teachers, and it was fascinating to see what happens in a school that doesn't get a lot of resources. I went to grad school in public policy. I spent 17 years in and out of the legislature as a legislative consultant, as a legislative director, and also as a chief of staff. Most recently to Tom McClintock was my first boss, and then John Morlock was my last boss, where I was his chief of staff. And we dealt with every aspect of education policy, budgeting, oversight, transparency, accountability that you can possibly think of. And so I've seen the broken system from the inside. I've seen it from the legislative angle. I also worked for Governor Schwarzenegger years ago and was part of his Department of Finance that did the budget for the kids that are in the correction system. So we actually have to educate them too, even though they've done terrible things and are incarcerated or wards of the state. So I've seen all those things, but now I work here and at California Policy Center. My job is to make sure that we're keeping an eye on the evolving issues of education. And most recently, I've talked about this dozens of times, our efforts are mostly focused around school boards and what's going on there and how they're interacting with different curriculum issues, discipline stuff. But what we're finding is the guy at the top sets the agenda. And if he's the guy that's always pushing forward the union angle on everything, then it makes it very difficult for those at the bottom, the school board members, the superintendents, the principals, to actually implement good stuff. And frankly, we have tens of thousands of incredible teachers in the state, wonderful teachers who were captured by their unions. And they don't want to do anything to offend those unions, because what they don't want to have happen is to have to go into the teacher's lounge and worry about what they're going to be, you know, criticized if they don't belong to the union. And we've worked on Janus issues and whatever. We'll talk more about that later. But here's a few things I would do. One is we have a framework system that doesn't work for developing curriculum in the state. And that's directed largely in part by the Board of Education and the Superintendent of Public Instruction. I come back to that and I would say, we've got to stop everything that's done in process for this reason. Parents have been neglected from the system for far too long. And so, you know, my campaign slogan, I've said it 1,000 times, I'll say it 1,000 more times, education doesn't begin or end in Sacramento. It begins and ends at the home, and we need to add parents back into the education equation. And so if we can do that and have a kids first agenda within the Department of Education, I think what we'll see is a dissemination of authorities, constitutional, statutes push back to the local levels. So they're not always worried about what the Wizard of Oz is doing in Sacramento behind that curtain.
Okay. So you and I have talked about this a bunch, and I know you know far more about education policy than I do. How effective can a superintendent, Lance Christensen, be in the face of a California Teachers Association that will be pounding you from day one, just opening up blistering attacks? You know, they'll be using their allies in the mainstream media to make sure that that message is amplified.
Well, as my grandfather used to tell me all the time, you're better known by your enemies than your friends. And so I find that the critique, the pounding for the teachers union, I actually welcome it. I'm excited about it. My wife, not so much. But I think that at some level, you've got to take swings at those that are really hurting our kids' education. And they keep bragging about all the wonderful things they did to reopen schools. They were the impediment to every step of the way of kids getting back and getting their education. And ironically enough, we were in the position of trying to help get schools back open when we know that public schools are not always necessarily the best place to go. We're, you know, I'm strongly in favor of parents having the choice to send our kids to an education or provide an education that makes sense to them, but also have the resources behind it. We pay lots in taxes. We pay $21,000 a year per kid for their education. That's a nice private school. And we're not getting private school education in our public schools. And so where is that money going? If you're a school that has or a classroom that has 30 kids in it or 35, that's $750,000 going to these classrooms. And so where is it? So I think, what could I do to push back? I could make sense of these issues that seemed so disconnected between the public and what happens in Sacramento. I think we should have had somebody pushing back against the governor for the last 2 years. I don't know. As far as I understand, Tony was nowhere to be found. He could have been on a Caribbean vacation for all we know. He wasn't around to do anything. And so having somebody every single day say, nope, not going to do that. We're going to turn it back over to the parents, back over to the school districts. We're going to trust our superintendents and principals to make the best decisions for their schools. And you don't have to come and beg and plead for Sacramento every day. I think, honestly, getting rid of a lot of power in Sacramento, it's a $125 million budget in that department every year. $125 million that probably could be $5 million in salaries and a few good, nice computers, where you just pass resources on to the districts and let them do what they've got to do.
Many of our listeners here won't recall that your last appearance on this show was actually to talk about a school choice initiative that CPC worked on, and then you took a leave of absence to actually go run that campaign. And pardon me. And unfortunately, the campaign stalled out and was unable to achieve a final victory. There was a parallel effort among some other folks, and neither of these efforts came to fruition. We didn't achieve a whole lot there in terms of electoral accountability. We weren't able to get our initiative passed, or we weren't able to get the signatures to get it qualified. What makes you think that parents are ready now, in a kind of like a Virginia Glenn Youngkin kind of way, where you had a lot of people, including myself, I think you would agree, parents played a key role in Youngkin's victory. And these were parents of, across the political spectrum. It wasn't just conservative parents. It was just parents in general who'd watched education just absolutely founder is the right word, I think, here. It had foundered during COVID. And then parents became illuminated as they watched over their kids' shoulders via distance learning. They watched how weird and twisted the curriculum had become, with very divisive racial theories being promulgated as legitimate ethnic studies. And on the other side, kind of gender bending stuff for young kids. And of course, Youngkin has swept to victory. But our school choice initiative here failed to gain that kind of energy and enthusiasm. And I wonder, what do you make of that? How do you square that with your ambition to win in June, you know, at least place high enough to have a runoff with Tony Thurman in November?
So I think a few things really quick is money is the mother's milk of politics. And if you don't have money to do things, it gets very expensive. And that was one of the main deals at the beginning. We knew that we had to have an initiative that would gather in a wide breadth of support and make sure that we could get people on the same page, and that when they would come to the table, when they would want to participate, that they would also pour in resources to get the word out. It costs $5 to $8 a signature to qualify something for the ballot. If you're trying to get a million signatures, that's $5 to $8 million. And that sort of money, for whatever reason, was not flowing in. And it was unfortunate. We tried a few different ways to really motivate the grassroots. So in the end, you've got to donate to things and causes that you appreciate, right? And nonprofits like CPC are no different. So you've got to make sure the resources are there, one. Two, I think a lot of parents saw what happened in Virginia and thought, wow, that was important. That was impressive, but that's Virginia. And then they saw what happened in San Francisco in February, and they were blown away. You have a school board that's 7 very progressive people on it. I mean, you're talking like full-on Marxist to liberal progressive. You know, that's the window of ideology in that group. And out of the 7, only 3 of them were eligible to be recalled. But as I've talked to people, they would have recalled every single one of those people for shutting down schools, for renaming schools for ridiculous reasons, for, you know, trying to kill their magnet schools and other kinds of things, as you've talked about on the show. 3 of those people were gone, and they had more votes against them than they had for them when they were elected. That's a stunning twist. When I saw that, I realized something has changed, and that maybe the motivation there with parents is a little bit stronger than it was last year. Maybe you don't get stuck in this really weird place where a lot of moderates or Democrats, they know that the school system is broken. But when you say school choice to them, it frustrates them because they think, well, let's save the public schools. So I'm thinking, if I can come up with a broader approach and say, listen, you make a decision about what you want to do. My goal is to empower you as a parent. I think that changes the dynamic. And it's not about killing public schools. I think public schools should exist. I think they should thrive. I think there's ways we can address that and improve them, but not telling parents that school choice is the only way you're going to fix it, but that you have power over the schools you're already in and that people are listening to, especially in hot topic issues like critical race theory or comprehensive sex ed or math is racist. I mean, that's the sort of stuff that we're dealing with right now. And most parents, they're just done. And they watched 2 years of COVID instruction over Zoom. They realized it was garbage. And so I'm hoping they're motivated. We'll see what turns out.
We saw in a number of recent teacher strikes that lots of parents came out to support the picketers and, you know, brought them water and food and held up signs endorsing their claims that they are underpaid and that they are the thin line between civilization and chaos. When you see those kinds of images, what would you like parents who support their local teachers, what would you like them to know?
Well, in some of these circumstances, as CPC has uncovered, they're actually not underpaid. They're actually on par or above pay and benefits with other like districts. And when you compare a lot of these salaries with the common person, you know, common families don't make that much money. But not to make it that sort of argument, but these teachers, knowing for 2 years these kids have suffered, to at the end of some of these kids' entire school career, you know, senior in high school. I have a senior in high school. So this to me is painful to walk out for almost 2 weeks and say, you know, we're not going to teach until we get more money. It had nothing to do with any other condition. They could have done that once school was out. But a lot of parents, I think, are sympathetic because they hear this, you know, the teachers are underpaid and under-resourced, which in some cases may be true, but that's not the way to negotiate these things, by holding your kids hostage. And now with the story is, at least in Sacramento City, last night, I think the news was reporting that in order for the state of California not to fine Sacramento City Unified School District, I think it's like $48 million for all the education instruction they missed, these kids' school year has to be extended by 6 days. And by an hour each Thursday, which is usually a shorter hour for most union-led schools, you've got parents that are mad. They have plans for the summer. They have other things going on. And they've got to send their kids back to school for another week and a half, 2 weeks possibly, because the teachers use that time. So if they don't do that, then they're going to pay another fine and then be $16 million underwater again after the strike. I just think parents are done and they're just frustrated with this. Will they make a change? Who knows? But California, as Ed Source pointed out 3 weeks ago, is 50th in the nation in literacy, 50th behind Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Tennessee, all the states that a lot of the elites in California make fun of read better than California students do.
Terrifying. What you haven't said here that I think bears underscoring is that you actually also were a pension expert for the Reason Foundation. We love Reason. How do you look at, you know, the teachers' demands for more cash, the implications for debt, you know, for unfunded pension liabilities and that sort of thing? Is that anything that the Superintendent of Public Instruction has a voice in reforming?
Yeah, absolutely. California in 2014 passed a reform, and I with air quotes there, to CalSTRS, which is the main pension for the teachers in the state. The problem is they didn't reform anything. They gave the board of CalSTRS some more, you know, gadgets and knobs to turn to fix things when they were making their investments. But what they said is we're going to now foist all of these costs back on the districts and on the teachers. So their pension contributions were small, relatively small for years. Now they're pretty high. In some places, like 18-19% of what they were paying before. And so when you think about that, the pension system itself is broken. And there are actually, there are studies that show that unless you teach in the school system for over 30 plus years and are consistent, then the pension system doesn't work for you. And especially with a lot of young moms, maybe they'll go into teach after college, they have some kids, take time off the family and then come back. The pension system doesn't work out for them. There are better ways to approach this issue. There are hybrid models out there. There are other defined contribution programs that work throughout the country that a lot of universities use. So I think being a voice for that kind of policy that actually brings money back into their pockets of retirement is successful. I don't want to take away people's retirement. I want to make sure that they're paid well. But I also, back to the earlier point, if we're bringing $21,500 per kid into each classroom on average, some are higher, some are lower, but it's pretty close. If we're bringing that amount in, then why are we paying these teachers, the good teachers, a lot more money? And then not getting rid of the new teachers as soon as some union teacher comes in and demands a nice position in a nice school and takes away from young teachers, which I personally witnessed and experienced. It's terrible. This last in, first out mentality is incredibly terrible. But we should also be bringing in other experienced professionals. There are a lot of people, say a chemist who retires from some corporation after years, who just thinks, I don't want to sit around in retirement. I'd like to go teach for a few years. But they don't want to go through this rigorous credentialing process that weeds out the best and the brightest. Give them a short little course on pedagogy and how to teach these kids, setting up lesson plans. That's like a few weeks max. Send them off in the world, let them teach high school or AP chemistry or physics or whatever the case is. Can you imagine having schools full of those kinds of professionals? They're not there for the money. They're there because they want to impart wisdom, but we're not incentivizing that kind of stuff. We need to, and that's what a superintendent of public instruction can do.
Wow. Okay, so one last subject here. Let's talk about how the mainstream media have covered your story. You know, you are a Republican challenger to the incumbent superintendent of public instruction, Tony Thurmond, who's gotten a lot of ink from the mainstream press, even if it's, you know, electronic virtual ink. But he's getting a lot of publicity, but not most of it is not good. The guy has been scandal plagued. And so one would think, I'd suppose, that your candidacy would attract a lot of attention in California and even nationally, because this is such a big and powerful state, very prominent. What's the coverage been like out there?
Minimal. So in my capacity at CBC, I've talked to a lot of people, of course, about the issues that are plaguing our system, the teacher strike, for instance, the SACB. I was quoted in there on some stories on that, and that was great. And they had, by in passing, said, and by the way, he's running for superintendent of public instruction. And so you know, it's a balance. I'm working really hard to make sure that I'm talking about the right things, but there's been a paucity of coverage on this race, which is amazing to me. I think this could be the most consequential race in the state this year. I mean, the governor's race is going to be important for sure, but honestly, education is 54% of our general fund budget. It's a huge amount of money, $126 billion last year. You would think that the next superintendent of public instruction should be the absolute focus of every article that's being written from here on out, especially with all the scandals that have gone on, you know, hiring your groomsmen for your wedding, doing those kinds of things. We need to be uncovering this stuff and saying, okay, what are the challengers saying? And I think if they were to spend any time, you know, my website, my social media, other places, they would know where I stand on these issues. And it's firmly behind parents. So
what do you suppose is going on? Why have you been marginalized or ignored generally, it sounds like?
Well, this race is interesting in the way that, again, as a nonpartisan race in California, the only constitutional nonpartisan race, if somebody is able to get 50% plus one vote on January 7th in the primary, the race is over. That person is then either reelected or elected newly. Last time around, it wasn't, there weren't a lot of voters that voted in the primary. So I think the idea is, let's just keep your head down. Let's keep the superintendent's head down and let's kind of protect the teachers union. And make sure that there's not a lot of focus there. Yeah, we've done our stories to show that what a toxic work environment he has and hiring friends from Philadelphia to do jobs that they shouldn't be doing. You know, those to me seem to be pretty significant scandals, but there's another one. I mean, right now we have 1,700 math professors, Nobel laureates, and math professionals and academics that have written an open letter to Tony Thurmond telling him to stop this new math curriculum framework because it's just woke and it's crazy. These are not conservatives, again. These are people that are really mad that math, 2 plus 2 is not 4.3.2, you know, some sort of weird equation. They just want math to be taught. And frankly, I agree with them. Because if you can't do the basic things like math, you can't do the basic things like engineering and chemistry and architectural stuff. There are so many things that build around this, but we've gone so crazy the other direction that even Tony Thurmond won't speak out against 2 plus 2 is 4.
Yeah. Lance, anything else you want to say before we head out here? I'd like people to know where they could get hold of you, where they could find more information, maybe your website. We could pop that in the show notes so that people can find out what they make of you.
Sure. I want people to have an open mind, and I want them to think hard about what kind of education their kids are getting. And for the 75% of voters that don't have kids in the system, or maybe it was a while ago, or they have grandkids, I want them to think about the future of California. And frankly, it's broken. And we can't go any further down in our system. So if they want to find more about me, they can go to LanceChristensen.com. All my social media bugs and tags are down at the bottom of the website. They can read my Medium blog, which I try to do on a regular basis, and make sure that I'm actually giving information that's important, that I'm relating to others. I want parents to know they've got an advocate in them. And I want to make sure they have a seat at the table. And that's why I would bring. So LanceChristensen.com and wherever else you're on your social media feeds.
All right. Lance Christensen, my friend, my colleague, good luck. That's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. That helps others find us. Please email us with your comments and story suggestions. You'll find our personal email addresses and other fun details in the show notes, including LanceChristensen.com. You can follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson and Lance Christensen, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa la semana próxima.